That was really life-changing to watch my 12-year-old and 10-year-old in Cambodia in a remote village building houses.
Welcome to the New Nomad Podcast, hosted by Alan and Andrew of Insured Nomads. Join us as Alan and Andrew interview and explore the community of people and ideas that embody the nomadic spirit. Tune in to incredible discussions with thought leaders each week that will help you take full advantage of the cross-border remote work lifestyle. Now, here are your hosts.
Welcome to the New Nomad. We have a really interesting guest today, David Richter, a person I've actually been fortunate enough to travel to Cambodia with, a person who's had a travel experience, someone who also supports people who are going overseas and traveling, as he provides really excellent benefits and healthcare advice, but also somebody who's done some great amount of volunteering through the Tabitha Foundation, which we'll have him talk about. But before we talk to David today, let's talk to my co-host, Andrew Jernigan. And Andrew, I know there's been a lot of conversation recently about this accelerating trend as employees are asking more of their employers on social justice. And then, of course, not just employers, their friends, their family, et cetera. And I know this is an area that you're very passionate about. And I'm sure we're going to hear from David today that he's passionate about all of us trying to make the world a little better place.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. This is exciting because global impact to local impact takes place by people that care. It's great to get this chance to dialogue on it. As I've lived around the world, I've been involved in local groups of expats, whether it be internations in their local service clubs or the American Society in Rio, you name it. Different places to where we mobilize people to actually volunteer, write checks, and encourage others to also. So it's as generations change in the mentality towards giving shifts, a lot of times people are thinking, okay, I can't afford to give personally. I can volunteer time. What do you think as we face the generational changes? What are your thoughts there, Alan?
I tend to see that baby boomers tend to be more amenable to writing checks, and the younger generation seems to be more amenable to volunteering time. Now, that could be a deeper economic conversation for another podcast, as one group might be stakeholders and the other ones may be stockholders. But it is quite an interesting change on that. The one thing that I thought was interesting, and we'll bring Dave into the conversation, is when he got a group of us together to go to Cambodia and build houses. It was a varied group. And I think there was a group of us, and I would say this on the older end, that this was one of the first physical volunteering efforts we did. And then there was a younger group, a younger cohort who had done this quite frequently and really opened my eyes up. The difference between writing a check and actually giving your time and effort. So David, welcome to the New Nomad. We're happy to have you here. And I would love your comments. You took us to a group of us to Cambodia. You've taken different groups. Some of the different learnings that you've had culturally about actually not only yourself, but shepherding groups to doing the right thing and meeting people in local situations.
Thanks, Alan and Andrew, for having me on. It's an interesting question, and I certainly have learned a lot. It's interesting the way that I got started with the Tabitha Foundation. I had worked in Beijing, working for Asia Emergency Assistance. And one of the physicians that supported us was an Australian doctor, and he had adopted a Cambodian child. He and I sort of parted ways, and I got reconnected with him in 2005. I said, so what's new? He says, I'm building houses in Cambodia. And what I heard was, and do you want to come? He didn't say that, but I heard it. And I said, and can I bring my wife and my kids? And he said, of course. And so off we went. And for me, that was really life-changing to watch my 12-year-old and 10-year-old in Cambodia in a remote village building houses. It was really remarkable. So I came back to the States, reached out to the organization, to Jan Ritzkus, who runs Tabitha, asked if I could lead trips. She said, of course. She said, why don't you join the board? I joined the board. So I've been on the board for the past 16 years and have been leading trips ever since. Some people say, oh my God, you went to Cambodia. Why would you do that? And other people say, can I come? It's the community of can I come people that I like to surround myself with. The other thing is, and I don't want to dive into politics too much, but I felt that I wanted the Cambodians to meet normal Americans. And I wanted to bring young Americans overseas to see how a lot of the rest of the world lives that is not all wrapped around, Xbox and iPods and all that kind of stuff. So the two met and I started recruiting people to come. It was really interesting. That first group I brought, I spoke with someone in, the Seattle Times, and she wrote up a little story about the trip that we were going to, that I was trying to put together. A bunch of people reached out to me immediately. I was on TV locally. I was like, this is incredible.
Yeah.
It's the universal experience of us showing up in the village and the villagers don't quite know what to make of us. We don't quite know what to make of them. We don't That's know right. if we build the houses. What are we going to do? But at the end of the trip, and we do the orientation with Tabitha beforehand, so we learn about the killing fields and the Khmer Rouge. We meet the people. The second day we go back to the village, the villagers are all excited to see us because they see that we came. We even came back a second day.
Yeah.
The houses are going up. The handover ceremony, where the houses are complete and we give the blankets to the families and they move in. It's just heartwarming. And then the debrief with the team afterwards, what everyone has learned and seen. Part of it is we make a promise a year in advance that we're going to go build these houses. And at the end of that year, we show up and we deliver on that promise. I'm proud of myself for doing it, but I'm also just really proud and thankful for the people that have supported me. It's really been great.
As somebody who joined you on what I think is a life-changing event, because, you know, people can go on a trip and visit the city and go to the museums, but until you get out there and meet the people, and then you do something that makes you feel like you made a contribution. And you're right, Dave, you know, not to get political, you know, for an American traveling to Vietnam and Cambodia that had family members that fought in the Vietnam War and see the people greet you with no animosity and open arms, and you greet them and you leave there saying, you know, what a wonderful place and people. It does change you. And I'll also say this, you as somebody who organizes, you have a lot of things on your plate. You have these folks coming that you don't want us to get sick. You don't want us to get hurt. You know, you've got to plan and take care of a lot of things. We've got to make sure that the sheet metal is where it's going to be for the houses. I know you have a lot of things on your plate, but for us, what I think we take away from there is just a feeling like you made a connection. And you're so right. From day one to day three, you can see the difference. And day one, it's kind of, we're doing our own thing. People are kind of, who are these folks? And by day two, you were starting to work together. And by day three, we're all in this together. Did you get that feeling also, Dave?
Absolutely. And I think, and it's interesting, you know, we don't speak Khmer and the people we build for don't speak English. But at the end of the 3 days, we're certainly communicating. Day one, people won't quite look you in the eye. Day two, they're smiling at you. Day three, they're not hugging people, but they touch your arm. They, you know, they're trying to make a connection. For me, it's amazing. And so each of my kids have been four times, and it's amazing what that launched their lives. You know, my daughter ended up working in Botswana. My son was in China. I mean, it's really colored the way that they've chosen to move on with their own lives, which is great. No, it's very fulfilling. A lot of good work to be done out there. So
there is. Dave, as I hear that, and I hear your passion for introducing this experience to other people from across the generations, what is it that actually fueled that for you? Was it something in your upbringing? What gave you this global outlook?
You know, Andrew, thank you for that question. It started when I was very young. I was 6 years old when my dad took a job in the Peace Corps, and he was a project evaluator and traveled around the world evaluating projects. And he would come home with frankincense and myrrh from Afghanistan and a Maasai spear from Tanzania, Ghanaian stools from Ghana. So we got all of this stuff around the house. And at the end of 2 years, he was assigned to be the deputy director of the program in Kenya. And so we moved to Nairobi. And so I was 8 years old, and I arrived in this just wonderland of wonderful people, animals, game parks, everything. And then we would go out to visit Peace Corps projects way out in the sticks. And the, you know, Africans would gather around me and my brother in particular. My brother was, so I was eight, he was six. We had little blonde hair, crew cuts, and the Africans loved to like just palm our heads. Like it was just, they would just rub their fingers through our hair and laugh. I mean, it was so joyful. And it was interesting because that could have been scary, but they were so clearly enamored with these little white monkeys that had showed up. It was so great, so warm. The experiences were great. I had great friends in school. I had a marble collection. And when our expat assignment was up, I split up my marbles amongst my best friends, you know, who were Kenyans and Indians and Pakistani. And it was a real treat. And so that opened the door, you know, opened my eyes to the world outside. And so when I went to college, I tried to study African history and politics. Nothing was offered. I ended up in Chinese studies. And luckily enough for me, graduated in 79. We normalized relations with China later that year. And I was a student at Nankai University in Tianjin in the summer of 1980. So one of the first Americans into China after the revolution. And we just had our 40-year anniversary. A bunch of us got together. And it was a real treat. But that, you know, the experience of being in China, and so very interesting contrast. In Africa, anywhere we went, if we stopped in the middle of nowhere, a large crowd would come and gather and rub our heads. In China in 1980, when we would stop on the street, hundreds of people would gather, but they looked at us like we were aliens and didn't know what we were all about. But invariably, and I was wearing shorts and a t-shirt because it was hot, invariably an old man would come out of the crowd and rub the hair on my arm and maybe touch the hair on my head. And then once we got, you know, we'd get a little bit freaked out and we would hop on our bikes and move on. To go to China today, they've leapfrogged couple centuries, you know, and tech capital of the world. It's really amazing. But I've continued to go to China over the years and actually studied in Taiwan for a couple of years. And one of the, Andrew, you were talking about expat groups that do things together. When I was in Taiwan, I ran every Sunday with the Hash House Harriers.
And yes. Okay.
What a treat that was. And we would always find, you know, it was up for the run leader to find an interesting place to run. So we ran in the mountains, we ran through town, we ran through rice paddies, and we always ended up at an interesting spot. Sometimes we'd pull into a dumpling restaurant and order 500 dumplings, you know, and you could order 500 dumplings and out they'd come. And it was a real treat. Some of the really, really fun memories from those times.
Well, you know, you brought up something that I thought was really interesting because of your tenure visiting these places. Isn't it kind of surreal to you that when you look at how some of these countries have changed in 40 years, you have these personal relationships, yet 40 years, it could be a quantum leap where, well, you mentioned Afghanistan. Afghanistan 40 years ago is quite a bit different than the Afghanistan we find today. China. So when you kind of reflect on your friendships and the people you've met, do you look wistfully sometimes back at those times? Do you also look happily at like 40 years ago in Cambodia was not probably anywhere near as good as it is today, progress being made? Conversely, 40 years ago in Afghanistan may have been better. What's your kind of feeling on that when you think back as a multicultural person and the friends that you've met there?
I think back to the early days in China where there were almost no cars on the road. You know, everyone was riding bicycles, which is almost cliche, but it's true. I lived in Beijing, 85 and 86, working for the U.S.-China Business Council. At the end of the day, we lived in the Peking Beijing Hotel, and I would run from the hotel down to Tiananmen Square and back. I would find a bicycle that was riding at about the pace I wanted to run, and I'd just run behind them. Well, people coming the other way, you know, were like always surprised to see this foreigner running down the street. And so they'd be looking like, you know, what's going on? And invariably, the guy would then turn around and see me chasing him. I wasn't chasing him. But I don't know. It was fun. It was the way that I was playing. But I think back very fondly to those days when Beijing, it was crowded, but we could go anywhere we wanted. My boss actually was able to rent an apartment at the Summer Palace, which is crazy. I mean, the Summer Palace was where the emperor would go to live. In China, there's a term for contradiction. It's Mao Dun. It's when a spear hits a shield, that's like a contradiction. And so the contradiction of foreigners living in the Summer Palace is just sort of, how did that happen? You know, I think back very fondly to those days, but my first summer in China, I lost 25 pounds because there was literally no food to eat. Yeah. And so China has progressed. The lives of the Chinese has improved dramatically. Some minorities are suffering for sure, but for the most part, their lives are better. So as reminiscent as I am of those cool times when I was like a rock star walking down the street, the Chinese have things much better right now.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing, and this is why I kind of bring the question up, is to those who are listening, who are thinking, should I travel to a certain spot? And if things are good, take advantage of it because it may change. I went to Ukraine and then immediately thereafter, we've had a lot of issues there. Conversely, if there's a place you want to see that's on your list, which might not be a place to travel to today, that might change too. Bide your time. But I think the message I'm taking from you is if you see an opportunity to visit somewhere and the time is right, a lot of times it's best to strike because the time may only be right now. And it sounds like you hit a couple of those.
Yes and no. So when we left Kenya as a family, it was 1967, and we were going to go to Egypt and Israel. But the 67 war broke out, so we didn't go. So we went to Lebanon instead. And we were in Beirut. I'm so thankful that we saw Lebanon at a time when it was peaceful. When I first started my company, Richter International, I've now merged with Gallagher. When I first started Richter International, since I was making this break, what I wanted to do was go to Timbuktu to sort of restart my life. It was like go to the end of the earth and start all over again. And I was planning on doing this and things happened. So when I was ready to go, there was a coup in Mali and you couldn't go to Timbuktu anymore. And so it's still on my bucket list. But I think you're absolutely right, Alan. If you've got something on your bucket list, get going. Because if it's safe to go, and today with COVID and political concerns and all that kind of stuff, yeah, this is the tough time. I bought my tickets to Bhutan. I'm going to Bhutan next March.
Well, Dave, I've heard several things that stuck out. One, you ran an emergency assistance center in China.
Correct.
You opened clinics in China that specialized in travel medicine and expat care, have worked in international benefit, full gamut of duty of care and benefits there. I could keep going because there's so much experience that you bring into this dialogue. We're fascinated by the social impact through Tabitha Foundation and the other aspects of your integrity. But can you speak on travel advice? Some of the things that you would bring into these people that are part of this tribe, listening as expats or managers of expats, or those thinking, I want to work from anywhere. What does that look like for me? I don't have to wait till I'm 60 to move to Portugal. I can do it now and keep working with my job. You know, what are some of those top things you'd say to that person from those perspectives, from those lenses?
So for me, the richness of the experiences that I've had, either living or traveling overseas, are immense. And so I wouldn't give them up for anything. So I think my advice, and in fact, I ran a call center in Beijing, and then I came back to the States and opened one in Seattle. And then we acquired, this was Asia Emergency Assistance. We acquired International SOS, closed Seattle, everything moved to Philly. And a lot of the people that worked for us in Seattle chose to do other things. One of them rode a boat from Skagway, Alaska, down to Seattle. Another one walked the length of Chile with his girlfriend, who then became his wife at the end of the walk. And a lot of this was inspired by the talks that we would have, you know, in the break room about adventures that I had had when I was their age. And so I really felt it was just so cool to watch these young people go off and take the adventures that they did. You know, one Brazilian girl took her Chinese friend to Brazil. You know, it was great stuff. And that was 1999, 2000. So about 20 years ago. So it's kind of a little generational difference, but we're in a period now where people can work remotely. And I would say, go for it. If there's a way that you can work that out with your company, I'm not selling insurance on this call, but I mean, insurance is an important piece of it. And so you need to figure out the answer there. I also think that the 24-hour medical and security assistance piece, like if you get sick, who are you going to call and how are they going to help you out? And I think particularly during COVID, it's very important to have that worked out in advance. But I would say this is the time to do it. My son was in China working for 3 years. He got a Fulbright and worked in Spain for a year. He's now in Oxford. He has certainly heeded my call.
Yes.
And is off doing his thing. And my daughter, who, you know, worked in Botswana for a year and then in Namibia after that, both of them have taken this to heart.
Well, you know, Dave, you touch upon something again that comes to mind is when you and I first started to travel, Andrew too, I mean, even China, I remember I didn't have a phone that worked. I had to go at the hotel, always get the special little card that the person would write out so I could get to the location. It's kind of saying to the group that's listening to you today is, if you have any doubts about going somewhere, the technology we all can put in your phone to protect you and direct you to care, maybe evacuate you, geoposition you, give you information, et cetera, is frankly so far beyond what we had. Even think about when you're driving a car. I mean, I remember driving a car in Europe in the old days when you had to get a map. And nowadays you put it into your phone. So please, people out there, there's so many tools to help make this easier for you than ever before. And I think, Dave, isn't that the thing that I would say that maybe is one of the biggest differences of traveling today? As much as you might think you have to rough it, if you've got an active phone in your pocket, you probably have a lot more technology than you need, provided you got things set up before you went.
You know, those things that come to mind with that question, especially is language and culture acquisition. You know, studying before you go a little bit beyond where you're going to stay and what you want to eat and the sights to see, but also the aspects of, okay, what are the faux pas? What are the things that you should and shouldn't do before a trip?
And you know, back to Dave's conversation, I mean, certainly purchasing a travel medical or some sort of support, making sure that you have secure VPN, make sure your phone will work overseas, maybe some geo-positioning areas there too. Really a tremendous amount of technology out there. It's kind of like going to the moon, you know, in a more modern, you know, I think about what you have on that phone today, geo-positionally, is so different. So Dave, with all the areas and travels that you've had, if you could share with our listeners maybe an overlooked place, person, idea, something that you feel that they should explore that might make as much of an impact as you did inviting me to join you in Cambodia.
So I think, you know, Alan, the Cambodia obviously holds a very special place in my heart. And so it's interesting. People say, you know, why do you keep going back to Cambodia? Well, because it's a special place in my heart. But what we've tried to do is add on a after trip. So one of my favorites was going to Luang Prabang in Laos, which is a sleepy little town on the Mekong River up in the mountains. It's an old traditional capital in Laos. It's a World Heritage Site that has French colonial architecture and magnificent Buddhist temples. And so you can sip French wine on the Mekong while monks are walking by. It's amazing. So that, for me, that's a very special spot. And you could do that after a Tabitha trip. The other place that is very special for me, so Africa continues to be very special for me. My wife and daughter and I did a really fun trip to Madagascar. Diversity of wildlife there is really amazing. So, and the lemurs and chameleons and all of these different species that exist only there were spectacular. And then another African destination, Namibia, is just spectacular scenery like I've never seen. And those are my three. I will say I've tried to support some charities in Africa as well. I supported a school called the Homomi Children's Center in Nairobi. I'm always looking for an opportunity to do something like that with an organization that I know if I'm giving a dollar, that a dollar is going to end up where it's supposed to. And so my daughter and I visited the Homomi school a number of years ago on our way to climb Kilimanjaro together. So anyway, there's always a try and weave it together with what you're trying to do. It's a great big world out there. There are so many special places to visit. So,
well, Dave, this has been great. Can you share with the listeners, and we'll include it in the show notes as well, the transcription, but can you share where people can reach you, where they can learn more about Tabitha Foundation and the work there in Cambodia, et cetera? Share with us.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm available via email. The email is Dave_Richter@ajg.com. The Tabitha Foundation is the organization in Cambodia, and that's just tabitha-usa.org. And I'd love to talk to people. I mean, it's, you know, I would love to talk to the people who are hearing this as, do you want to come?
You know? There you go. Yeah. And hopefully, Dave, we can join you. I mean, this year is going to be difficult, but hopefully early next year. So I'm planning to try to join you. Really appreciate your time. Really appreciate all your efforts in helping others, and a huge difference not only to those folks, but the people who come on this adventure with you leave there forever changed. So thanks again. And thank you, listeners, for listening to us today. We want to remind you the New Nomad's not just a podcast. It's a community of people, ideas, and spirits helping you take advantage of the location independent lifestyle. We'd love it if you subscribe to the New Nomad podcast. Please review our discussions. Beyond our typical podcast platforms, you can find us at thenewnomad.net or insurednomads.com. But please stay well, keep sharing your best adventure with others, and thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for tuning in to the New Nomad Podcast, where we bring together an incredible community of people and ideas that embody the nomadic spirit. Please remember to subscribe and leave a review. For more amazing tips to help you take advantage of the cross-border lifestyle, please visit us at insurednomads.com/podcast. See you next week.